Or if you'd have gone out and gone with you. My game is animals. And but today, I guess the announced subject is listening to animals and people. But if you know me well, the title doesn't really have much to do with what I say. But you're always pressed for a title. What I'm going to do to you today is to address the subject of listening. I've done it in various forms up here. I'll give you hopefully a sort of a shortened version. And that's about half the time. And then I want to tell you about what I've been spending, in summary form, what I've been spending my time on. Most of my time for the last 15 years. Or 16 years. And so that's what we're about. I should open with to be orthodox. I'll open with Martin Luther. Our Lord gave the greatest and loveliest gifts to the most common animals, but men do not seek them there. Some women do, but most men don't. In fact, in veterinary medicine today, it's improving every year because there's a higher percentage of women entering every year. And seem to have more compassion. The subject of listening, I feel I'm qualified to address this issue since I've been married for 47 some years. And certainly the lament of every parent, every child, every husband, every wife, every teacher, every student, every preacher, every parishioner is this: you have ears but you do not hear. I can tell you all kinds of stories. I could spend the next hour telling you about stories of poor listening. I'll give you a very short one. My mother's family came from Norway, settled in south of Mount Vernon, in a place called Milltown. The oldest boy of eight in the family was Louis. Louis was complaining a lot when he got up in his 60s, but he'd never been to a doctor. So he finally went to the local doctor in Stanwood, and the receptionist said, strip to the waist. So he took off his pants. Because about my family, they hear but they don't listen. I have studied this subject a good deal, collected a good deal of information, and reach a conclusion that about 98% of what we learn through our eyes and our ears, if we can hear. And there have been some studies since the big war on looking at this. One of the fellows that did this was a fellow named Rankin from Ohio. And he was interested in how these people would respond and what percentage of their time was spent in listening. In communication, and listening was only one part of it. And he realized that of this group that he studied here in Ohio, I suppose blue and white collared workers, about 70% of their day was spent in communication. And on the breakdown of this, about 9% was in writing, 15, 16, 17% in reading, 28% in speaking, 45% in listening. Yet when I first saw these figures back many years ago, I says, you know, in my own case, I've gone to school half my life, and how have I spent this? A lot of time learning how to read, learning how to write. I had one course in speech, but I never had an organized course in listening, and yet that's what I've been doing much of my time. And that didn't sound quite right. I looked up some other data. I studied a fellow named Jones in Ohio, and Jones at Columbia University. He's a psychologist, and he was disturbed at how much he got back from the students when he'd give them brilliant lectures. And then he'd give them an exam. I ran into the same problem. That's one of the reasons I got interested in it. And I may refer to that later. But what he did, he prepared his presentations very well. And then he, as soon as he finished the lecture, he gave them a test on what he thought they should have retained from what he told them. And he was very dismayed to find out that they only retained about 50% of what he thought they should. He waited 2 weeks, gave him the same test, and it was down to 25%. Well, you can't run a business on this kind of efficiency. And there was a fellow named Nichols at the University of Minnesota, and he read Jones's stuff and said, you know, there's probably something wrong with these people at Columbia, that's the students, you see. So he corralled up a bunch of the herring chokers that frequent the University of Minnesota. And he used a little different technique. He went to some of the people he thought were real communicators. He says, here's what I want you to do. I want you to give 15 minutes of your best lecture, and then give me an exam that I will give to them right after the lecture of what you think they should have retained from it. And he was really shocked when he found out it was about a 50% retention. He didn't wait 2 weeks, waited only 2 days, and it was down to 25%. I could have told him that because I was born and raised with Scandinavians. what he did about this, what Nichols did about it, he studied these and he studied the people that were sort of below 25% retention in 2 days, kind of an interesting group, and that was about half of them. It was a large number of them were below 25%, you see. But what are the characteristics of these people? He looked at the characteristics of bad listener. Now, I have modified his list and improved it. I don't know if he'd think that, but I don't care. And so what I'm going to do now is to give you some of the characteristics of bad listener. I won't give them all, but you recognize them in your friends, maybe in your mates. And in the cool of the evening, you'll probably also recognize them in yourself. The first thing that the bad listener does is decide the subject is uninteresting and useless, and thus turns them off. Now, G.K. Chesterton is one of my favorite authors. He wrote a lot of beautiful things. Most beautiful was about pigs. But I liked him even before then. But he says, there's no such a thing as an uninteresting subject, just uninterested listeners. So when you're trapped, you take it as a challenge and see what you can get out of it. Even if the announced subject is the care of camellias in nuclear attack. Another thing the bad listener does is to wait and deliver a speech carefully rehearsed while listening. You can't do it that way, nor this way. Listens carefully for flaws in the presentation so that at the first opportunity they can clobber the speaker. Or this one, fails to comprehend nonverbal communication. And this is a... It was shocking to me to find a study in which the this person said, you know, how much of communication is dependent on verbal, on what you say in the words, versus the tone of the and your voice versus body language. And in one study it was about 7 to 9%. It was less than 10% of what the words did. About 35% in the voice intonations and various characteristics of the voice, and way over 50% of other body language. This did shake me up, but it's to emphasize the importance of nonverbal communication. And I noticed this when I was first married 47 years ago, last June 13th. In those days, we expected the wife to get up and make breakfast and have breakfast ready. And I expected that, but it didn't work out. I'm a very early riser. I'm kind of a Jerry Ford type guy. Get up and make your own breakfast. And my wife, you're lucky to find the kitchen. You know. She found the stove was almost at that hour in the morning. And she'd put the tea kettle on the right rear, turn on the right front or left front burner, and put the raisins in my Russian tea. I mean, generally mess things up. So it was not consistent with a long marriage. So I said, what you do is stay in bed till I leave. And I'll see you tonight. And she'd, I don't know what time she got up, but she always had dinner ready. So it worked out, but you see, I didn't respect this. One of the good things, a good example of this, it's sort of what you're interested in, but also sort of how you understand a thing. And I'll never forget this story. It was this fellow from Manhattan came down to New Mexico to go to school. And his roommate, I think most of the time that he was at Las Cruces, was spent there with his Native American roommate, and they became very good friends. But the fellow from New York, he was insisting, you know, you ought to come and visit me in Manhattan sometime. After all, you know, we bought it from you. And he was delayed in this. It wasn't until after he graduated that he finally got back there. And one day they're walking along, he was showing them Manhattan, he was going along by Theater Row there, and it's really noisy. I mean, just, you know, cars going by, buses, I mean, it's very noisy, but there's some potted plants along there. And as they were walking along, the Native American said, I hear a cricket. He says, you've got to be out of your tree. You can't hear a cricket here, you know. He went over to one of these trees, pulled out a cricket. He says, well, that's remarkable. Yeah, he says, you see, it all depends on what you're trained to hear, he said. And he took a 50-cent piece, I don't have one, I just have 25 cents. He threw it on the ground, he threw it on the sidewalk, and 10 people dove for it. So it's all what you're trained to listen for. So pay attention to that. Another thing that bad listening does is he can't cope with periods of silence and use them effectively. And I've done some experiments on this. A lot of people talk at about 110 words a minute, so you got some time there, and then sometimes they're telling some tired old jokes that you've already heard, and so there is that time, and then sometimes they lose their place, and I'm very good at that. And when I was a dean, I'd talk a lot. Only time the Rotary Club or the Kiwanis invited me to speak, I spoke, because they run the country, you see. Or the Lutheran women. So I do this, but with the Rotary and the Kiwanis, you have very strict time constraints. They usually get pretty busy, and they find it, oh, we got a speaker, you know, and you got to do it in 20 minutes. And they all leave. So you speak pretty fast. And if you find that you speak pretty fast, if you go along about 200 words a minute, you'll find out that people pay very close attention to you, and it goes along like this. And then I'd stop, lose my place, and look for it. And you'll find out that after about 25 seconds, the natives become very restless. And they start, you know, wondering if the old geezer has had a heart attack. So the take-home lesson is that when you're listening to someone, and they're telling you some tired old jokes you already know, or talking about a subject you already know probably more about than they do, you lose that time for recapitulation. See, as you go through the point, say, what was that number one point? What's the number two point? So that you're taping it and redoing it. If there had been a shortcut to learning, I think I would have found it outside of reusing. There's no shortcut. So that's, you utilize that time efficiently. And you put up with periods of silence, you use them effectively. Another one is to fake attention. When Ray and I went to Lincoln High School, we had 100 people in 4 years of high school. And we had Mrs. Tunham, and she was always putting on a play. And she'd hunt us down. And even if we hid, she'd find us. And that was one of the toughest jobs I ever had to do, was play a part of be somebody else. That's a hard job. The thing here is to you don't carry along around a facade is a very heavy piece of merchandise. So you be yourself. That's a lot easier. And to make this point, I often tell a story about a psychiatrist. I got a lot of psychiatry stories, but this one was a very busy psychiatrist in a large town, and he had already gone over 5 o'clock, and he was about to leave, and but his receptionist caught him as he's going out the back door. She says, "You got to come back. You got to see this guy. He's lowering a snake in a wagon track." And he said, "Okay, I'll come back." So the guy pours out his heart. It was a hard case. I mean, he was really down. And this psychiatrist, and we in the health professions, we're often pressed not only for diagnosis, but also a treatment. I mean, how do you tide them over till tomorrow? But you act very confident about this. And the psychiatrist, who was a circus buff, said, "Here's what I want you to do tonight." He says, "There's a great circus in town, a really great circus, a lot of great acts." He says, "You won't be able to take in all the acts, but there's one I don't want you to miss, and that's the clown. He's the greatest clown I've ever seen. Don't forget the clown." Long period of silence, and then his patient said, "I am that clown." It's hard to play a part. Another thing that the bad listener does is to tolerate the bad performance of the lecture, or the bad performance in anything. We do owe one another the benefit of constructive criticism. It was C.S. Lewis, one of my favorite authors. I think he said, "A friend is not a friend if he doesn't care whether I lie, cheat, and steal." We got to care. And I often tell my students, you judge what you say to another person on the basis of the answer to 3 questions. Is it kind? Is it true? Is it necessary? Now, many times I felt, after I lose sleep for a few nights, somebody really teed off on me. I said, "Well, it was probably necessary, but it didn't seem very kind, you see, and it was true." But I realized in the long run they had done me a great favor. But we do this gently, with warm fuzzies. I'll never forget here in this room many years ago, I shared this podium with many others. One of them was Walter Capps, a famous theologian, professor of theology and religious studies at the University of Santa Barbara. In fact, our daughter Karen babysat for him. Reverend Grimsrud's son-in-law, married one of Grimsrud's daughters. And he's very interested in the contemplative movement. He's a graduate PLU and Yale School of Theology. And he's interested in contemplative movement. And he's visited a lot of monasteries. And it was a large monastery in the Midwest that he'd visited, and he stayed there quite a while. And he got to know some of the people. One of them was especially interesting to him. This monk had been there for 43 years. And he said, "If you had it to do again, would you do it again?" He said, "Well," he says, "I've given that a lot of thought. And my sisters and brothers who didn't enter the monastic life, I compared them, and I guess we came out about the same place. But," he says, "I think I would do it again. But," he says, "there's a couple of other things I'd like to share with you." He says, "You know, I could sit down now and write many volumes about what's wrong with the Catholic Church, and it'd all be true. I could write many volumes of what's wrong with America, and it'd all be true. But," he says, "you know, that takes no talent. What really takes talent is to be generous." So we do it with warm fuzzies. Another thing that the bad listener, and in this, it's so important to inform rather than infirm. And that's, we're great critics, aren't we? They spend their life in criticism, infirming rather than affirming. As I tell all my classes, we as a people are by nature nurturers, have been for thousands of years up until a very recent past. And that's how we as a people made it, by nurturing one another, our animals, and our natural environment. And that's one of our big problems today, is a majority of our population do not have suitable objects of nurture. They become self-nurturers, and that's devastating. Especially in our male population today, I feel, and psychiatrists agree with me, that they do not have suitable objects of nurture. Another thing that the bad listener does is to allow emotional words to throw them. And I don't know what your hang-ups are, but I could go through 20 words here and I'd probably lose all of you. The way you lose me in a hurry, and I went through this, Ray and I went through this in grade school, high school, we had to learn that Columbus discovered America in 1492. I mean, he was a Johnny come lately. In my living room, there was Leif Erikson discovering America, a picture of him doing that. And so all you got to do is say, you know, oh, Leif Erikson discovered America in 1492. Boy, and you've lost me, huh? On Columbus Day, send Leif Erikson cards. That's what I do. Another thing that the bad listener does is to fail to realize the uniqueness of every person. How many times do we say, well, she is just an average person, he is just an average person? There's really only one of those, you know. Only one. We're all different. All different. All unique. And in this, I refer again to C.S. Lewis, if I can find it. In Through a Joy and Beyond, he said, there are no ordinary people. You have never talked to a mere mortal. Nations, cultures, arts, civilizations, these are mortal, and their life is to ours as a life of a gnat. But it is the immortals whom we joke with, marry, snub, and exploit. Immortal horrors are everlasting splendors. All day long we are in some degree helping each other to one or the other of these destinations. And that's a heavy. So treat them all as a great creation of a great creator. Another thing a bad listener does is to question for victory rather than clarification. That's our society today, you know, the professors, the students, professors, me, husband, wife, and friends, huh? We're always out there for victory, to outpoint them. I can give you a lot of sad examples of that in married life and all, where they just really weren't communicating, but questioning for victory. Another thing that the bad listener does is to criticize the speaker for ineptness and other things. I'm an excuse, Norwegian is a foreign language I learned. I don't do well in it either. But if a person came in here, running in here now, maybe he's the local janitor into your enterprise and says, get out of this rat nest, it's on fire. I wouldn't turn to him and say, couch that in better rhetoric. I'd get out of there. I understood him. Or how a person dresses. Like when talking to the Lutheran women one night, they didn't have a podium. They're great for circling the wagons, and they all sit around so they can see each other and everybody. And so I got up like this so I could kind of look over them and see them. I'm crippled now. And I had a red sock on one and a green sock on the other. Now I got a red and a yellow, a brown one here. But I threw them, you know. I mean, they were writing each other's notes. And I've had this in students, too. In fact, in University of California, yeah, I save ties. I do a lecture on ties. In fact, I did one the other day. I get ties from all over, and some of them are pretty crazy. Some of them I have my wife make, like this one. And this was in the days when I was at the University of California pontificating. I have belly warmers. In the old days, you know, we had white ones. Well, I had my wife make this belly warmer. You see, and it has a zipper. And you can carry things in it. And And it's utilitarian because you can put a small hot water bottle in here, so you have a real belly warmer. And you can carry notes in here for your talk. If you go and speak to the Weight Watchers Club at lunch, carry a sandwich, and I recommend that. A lot of places, they don't have dessert anymore, and I like dessert. Maybe you know of some places like this. And I have peanuts, I have candies in here. I have quite a collection here. In fact, I'll use that tonight. So that's kind of handy. But I'll never forget, when I was at the University of California, I was teaching the select of the select. I mean, the people that went to the University of California Davis went highest 7% of the graduating class in high school. But I wasn't talking to them. I was talking to the select of those in veterinary medicine. Those that couldn't get into veterinary medicine went into medicine. So they were a discriminating bunch, but sit in one of these places where it goes up forever, you know. And I was wearing my gray lab coat and had my belly warmer on, and they introduced me. And I was going to give them a talk on this, and as I walked to the platform, my belly warmer, they all got exophthalmos, you know. And that's when they went like this, you know, with each other's notes. The point of all this, well, I should say that you not only carry things in here, but most people don't wear ties now. But if you do, if you think about it, they're about the most worthless thing you can get. And all they do is collect gravy and soup. And unless you're going to be a slob, you got to get them clean. And that uses up resources. And it's costly. With this one, you see, if you hold it right, you can catch the soup and the gravy in here. I haven't cleaned this for years. Isn't too bad either. But I don't recommend them. The bane of my life when I was an administrator were cocktail parties. And I can tell you, if you wear this at a cocktail party, before the night is out, some turkey will come up to you and put his arm around you and say, "Hey, buddy, the fly on your tie is half open." So the reason I make this point and go into all this is that why do you go and hear someone? You go there for edification, I mean to learn something, to put it in the structure you already have, where does it fit in to make it right, or you go for laughs. You do not go there to make judgments on how they look. At least I always preach that. But that's what you go for. You don't go for these other things to make these. And for me, a lot of times, the only thing I prepare is the first paragraph. And by the time you've made all these judgments, you've missed the only thing I prepared. So that's that. Now, there's another element to this, and it's here on this card. And it says, this is Native American saying, it says, "Keep silent or your tongue will make you deaf." And that's true. You can't learn anything much while talking. And also, tell them about Dr. Bonhoeffer. He was taken out and shot in another camp before I was released for the third time in Germany. He was a great theologian, and he had something to say about this to his compatriots. As you know, he was taken out and shot for his complicity with on the threatened the life of Adolf Hitler. He said, "The first service that one owes to others in the fellowship consists in listening to them. Just as love to God begins with listening to his word, so the beginning of love for the brethren is learning to listen to them. It is God's love for us that he not only gives us his word, but also lends us his ear." And that's in the universal sense, our brother and our sister. We owe him that. And that's maybe one of the greatest things you can do for a person. I spend a lot of time listening to people who are grieving, often those who have lost an animal that was like a child to them. And Godfrey got to this, John Godfrey, a lawyer in a big town. His wife had died and he'd been relatively successful. His town grew around him and he decided he'd do something for the town before he died, so he contacted the best architect in town. He built a fantastic building. He wouldn't tell anybody what it was all about until the day of the dedication. Inlaid in gold over the door were these words, "The man who listens." And at the dedication, by way of explanation, he gently told them, "One of the most terrible aspects of this world today is that nobody listens to anyone else. If you are sick or even dying, nobody listens. If you are bewildered or frightened or lost or bereaved or alone or lonely, nobody really listens. Even the clergy are hurried and harassed. They do their best and work endlessly, but time has taken on a fragmented character. It doesn't seem to have any substance any longer. Nobody has time to listen to anyone, not even those who love you and would die for you. Your parents, your children, your friends. They have no time. That's a very terrible thing, isn't it? But whose fault is it? I don't care, but there doesn't seem to be any time." Now, these are really the words of Taylor Caldwell in her novel, The Listener. But you don't have to go to fiction to find this. I can give you all kinds of stories, and you know of people who don't listen, and it ends in trouble. Now, I have to telescope this a little bit. So two other things I want to bring up here. This fellow is from Richard Bach. He says, "It's not the crowds that wear me. It's the kind of crowd that doesn't care at all about what I came to say. You can walk New York to London on the ocean. You can pull gold coins out of forever and still not make them care, you know." And when he said that, he looked lonelier than I'd ever seen a man still alive. He didn't need food or shelter or money or fame. He was dying of his need to say what he knew, and nobody cared enough to listen. To listen to someone gives them a feeling of self-worth, which is a scarce commodity today. I won't tell you, have time to tell you about Brom Beck, one of my favorite writers. But important as it is to listen to people, it is even more important to listen to God. And we must first listen to God. Al Rodness, who was here just now, and my first time here was 63, and we had a fall seminar. And he was here. He's been a dear friend of mine for many years. He said, "You either hear him everywhere or you hear him nowhere. But to hear him, you must first hear him in Jesus Christ. God remains a vapor and therefore not the great God of creation until you have him in the person of someone who walked among us. And he did walk among us. And he came not as a tourist, but he came to stay. And we must listen to him. But there's a risk in listening to him. For then you risk hearing other voices, the groans, the cries of people with problems, some as close as your own home or the one next door, or the cries of the unfortunate of the world, like in Cameroon, where our daughter Karen spent two remarkable, successful years of volunteer service in a mission school. The risk in listening to this Jesus is that it can change your life, or as in the case of Karn's commitment, it could cost a life, which it did her. And as parents or her sister and brother can tell you, it's the ultimate of tragedy. It's something you never recover from. And as my wife grieved, and as I grieved over this, I told my wife one day, "You know, we could have prevented this. We could have not taught her about Jesus." But we chose to. And we'd do it again. Now we shift gears to the slides. You know how to turn on the slide projector? Here, I'll. If I can remember. And the lights, let's see, does anybody have the lights on? Somebody asked about my wife. This is my wife. I call her the Chief. Her name is Signe. And when we were at the University of California, she complained a lot about me being gone so much. So I said, "Well, we'll get a dog." I think she already had a cat, but I get her a dog. And she said, "What should we call it?" And I said, "Well, great reluctance, so that whenever I leave you, I can leave you with great reluctance." And so this, she had developed a very strong bond with this animal. And to show you the kind of attachment you can get to an animal, this is the Chief here driving this white rabbit. She doesn't drive it very well. In fact, not long ago she did have a crash. She drives something else now. But it was appropriate she drive a white rabbit. And the caption on this, that's me in my Norwegian sweater, but the caption on this says, although Great Reluctance is 16 years old, he still loves to chase cars. But this human-animal bond, which I'm going to be talking about now, an animal facility therapy, it didn't begin with my wife and I, and with Great Reluctance, but she now has, she's more even stronger, more strongly bonded to a hearing dog named Bridget, who has been here. I wish she would have been here to demonstrate today. But she's had it since she lost her hearing on April 14th, 1981. It's her freedom. I mean, she can be independent without me, probably does better without me as it is. But when my visit to the Maasai, it had it impressed on me so indelibly that these are a people that, when I saw them in the 70s, that's probably the same way as they were doing it thousands and thousands of years ago. And they survived because they were nurturing of one another, nurturing of their animal, which is all critical to them, and the natural environment. And that's how they survived for thousands of years. It's only in the very recent past that we've been separated from our natural environment, from animals, and in this recent generation, from one another. Our greatest problem today is loneliness. More people are choosing to live alone, or if married, not to have children. And they have turned in on themselves, and they're, as I mentioned. So this is impressed upon me by them. With industrialization, urbanization, mechanization, everybody's off the farm except a few percentage, and they're separated then from these natural, from the natural environment to our own problems. Now, I'm sorry if I did not get back to you sooner, Mr. McDonald, but our computers were down. We use that excuse for everything. When I became a dean, or when I was appointed dean, I says, well, what should we be doing as a profession? What should I be doing with my life? And it was the second time where I had a good deal of time to do this because I had accumulated a lot of vacation at the University of California, and they didn't start paying me till September 1, so I came 2 months early. And then I could pretty much do like I wanted. And I did a lot of thinking about what we should do. And I looked up, I listened to the animals. I mean, what's happening to the animals? Up to, in 1974, up to 18 million dogs and cats were killed in our animal control centers. And that isn't all of them. Huh? And 80% of them, you might say, well, they were strays. No, 80% of them were owned by people. That's a lot of blood on the floor. Up to 50% were behavioral problems that could have been prevented. Well, we have to take some of the responsibility for that. There's a lot of bad treatment of the animals, and a lack of reverence for life. The wrong person was the alpha animal, huh? The wrong pack leader. They didn't train their animals. This is entitled Man's Best Friend, and he can't even hit the fire plug. One of the things you are Scandinavian and maybe other nationalities too, the people train you to respect old people and handicapped people. And my mother used to take me with her to see old people. When I was young, I didn't think that was fun and games. But I continued this through my life. And I met so many people like this. They were sitting alone in their room, it's often bare room, and just waiting to die. They knew nobody needed them, and a lot of times, even if they had relatives, they hardly ever showed up seeing them. Often they told me one of two stories, many of them. Said, I was living independently in my home with my animals, happy. And then either two things happened. They ran out of money and had to go to government housing where, at that time, animals were not allowed. Or somebody laid a guilt trip on them and says, we know we can't, we worry about you being there, you're going to fall down and we'll never find you and the terrible things will happen. We'll take you to this nice nursing homes where animals were not allowed and we'll take care of the animals. Meaning in most cases, they'd kill them. Taking away from many of them at that point in their life, the only thing that gave them unconditional love. were forgiving, was a socialization element for them. Made them feel needed. If a dog organized their life, many animals organize their life. If it was a dog required exercise, it was a source of security, and most important of all, it was fun and laughter. And it was a source of touch. Old people aren't touched much. We all need touching. If we aren't touched, we die. And of course, humor is probably our best therapy today. So we said we got to do something about this, and we did. We formed the People Pet Partnership Program, which is composed of many elements. The first one is Pet Education Partnership. Take a chapter of the Catholic Church or Kellogg's. Get them when you're young, and maybe you got them. And that's what we did. I got the students to teach a night class for the community. But we said, if you're really going to make an impact, you got to get to the kids. And that's what we did. And we formed a book called Learning and Living Together, Building the Human-Animal Bond. And we bring in animals. There's a stepwise course, and here you can put 3, 4, up to 5 people on a dog this size, and it's cost-effective. But you have a laying on of hands. Here's the book we put together. It's been revised, and it's in several school systems today, here and abroad. I imagine it'll be translated in some languages. When I get to be dictator, it'll be in all the school systems of the world. I've also started a course in Reverence for Life, which I've taught at 7 different universities, and presently teaching it in my 7th year at Washington State University. Here's the curriculum. You see grade 1 and on up to grade 6. We're adding other lessons. The last one we added was when your best friend is gone, pet loss and bereavement. Many children are not brought into these decisions. Many of them are suffering from grief, and this must be handled. Many of them do not. We do not give them exercise closure. We lie to them often about what happened to the animal. And when they find out about it at the age of 30, they still carry lesions. Companion animal partnership. I visited, as I say, nursing homes and convalescent homes most of my life. I visit them a lot more now because that's where most of my old girlfriends are. But we started out, in fact, there weren't animals in any of our nursing homes, convalescent homes in our area. And in a course, Dean Flaherty, my wife and I really started out with great reluctance in our local convalescent home, but they didn't want us in there with the animal until some women bought the place, and then they allowed it. But this was the first one placement we made, and Dean Flaherty in his class brought some cats and placed them in nursing homes in Moscow, Idaho. It was easier to get in there. They grew up to be cats. This one was named Geriatrics, and now it really is geriatric. But it had kittens, and then the party really became informal. And they've had animal association. In fact, there's animal association now in all our nursing homes. And this is a very expanding thing. There's thousands of programs throughout the world now in many other countries. I know I've been in Australia, and there I helped them get going. In Japan, they're going at it. And in Europe, and in fact, we have another international congress in Monaco in November. This is an interesting case. We got a call one day in People Pet Partnership from local convalescent home. They said, we need your help. We need to fill a prescription. And what's the case? Well, Waller's doctor says the only thing that's going to help him is a dog. So he wrote RX dog. So you have to get the right kind of dog. We finally found Boof. Head doesn't match the rest of him, but he doesn't care, and neither does Walter. It had to be one that didn't crush him because he was pretty much bedbound. And they were very cooperative up there. They cut a hole in the wall, and so old Boof could get outside when Walter was giving him a bad time. And there's no way Walter's going to come through that hole. But I should tell you now, why did he write this prescription? Well, Walter just wanted to die. He didn't even want to see his grandchildren. His daughter was very upset. And his grandchildren weren't all that bad. When he got this dog, he called up his grandchildren, he had something to show them, and so his last days were pretty good days. Here's another case, and that's her name is Marie. And Marie was a stroke victim. And if you went up to see her, she'd be laying in a fetal position, didn't care whether the school kept her not, and just doing you bug off. And she'd had a history of cats. She had another problem. She had sores on her legs which wouldn't heal. They tried everything. Well, we told them, we'll set up a cat room here, a cat therapy room, And then you staff can vote on who you think will do the best in there, and they all voted for Marie, so they moved Marie in there. Now, and people, of course, would come and see her because it's a socializing element, you see. They didn't maybe care much about Marie, but they liked her cat. But the other, what happened was, in 5 weeks, she was all healed up. Her sores were all healed up because, see, whenever she started scratching these sores, that was the main reason they weren't healing. The cat, of course, would jump on her and divert her because the cats thought she was playing with them. And so in 5 weeks, it's a remarkable therapy. And in 6 weeks, she was on PM television, PM magazine television. And she had 3.5 good years. She was meditating well. Well, I know I went to Georgia before I left, and I went up to see her. She and the cat had a great time together for 3.5 years. You wonder what the dog is, that's Daisy. Eleanor carries Daisy around the basket. That's why we call her Daisy the Basket Case. She knows a lot of tricks, and she visits people, but she also visits the cat because these are good buddies. To make the point that it isn't fair to have a flaky person give an animal to a flaky person and end up with a flaky animal. It isn't fair to the animal. You see, so you pick them very carefully, but you also respect that animal. You don't make it a tough thing for the animal. They both got a benefit from it, you see. And we will now put up guidelines for animals in nursing homes. It's a second edition, and it's used in many places throughout the world in this country. And it works. Prison partnership. I'm a former prisoner myself. I have some compassion for those in lockup. I befriended a girl who was named Kathy, who was in bad straits. She had been incarcerated 35 times in 14 different institutions, which gives you a PhD in prisons. And she had 20, that was from the age of 13 to 20. And she is permanently scarred from this. She's now a sister, Sister Pauline, helping displaced persons. But she could train a dog to do anything. And she said, I told her she should get a wheelchair and train her dog. She could train the dog to do anything. And one day she had in her parish, she had this disabled person, he was a thalidomide guy, to come and visit. And he wanted a dog. And the guy, she says, here's what we ought to do. We ought to go over to Washington Correction Center for Good Harbor, it was called Purdy before. It's a maximum security prison for women. And we'll have the selected women under guidance of two of the best trainers I can find to train them to train animals to help handicapped people, and they'll meet the handicapped person that they're going to train for. I says, yeah, and you're going to do one other thing. You're going to take animals out of Animal Control Center, and you're going to give them obedience training, because obedience training will change a person. And they also learn a lot about dogs. I know I sent my wife and her dog to obedience training and did them both a lot of good. second from the right is Sue. She's a lifer for reasons. And she's now a hero to about 38 people. She's trained animals for them. The first one was with this fellow that I told you about, who is a thalidomide. He's trained Glory for him and changed his life. It's remarkable. This is a real classic case. Angie was born with about 12 to 14 kind of seizures. Some of them were life-threatening. She'd quit breathing. Required the presence of her mother or father night and day everywhere. Sometimes they wouldn't catch her in time. She'd quit breathing and wipe out her memory. When she was up in her wheel, she'd strap to a wheelchair. So they brought her out and introduced her to Sue. And she trained Sheba for her to retrieve and be a companion. What happened was that now for many years, Sheba initially picked up on her seizures. And she told her when she's going to have a seizure before she knew she was going to have a seizure. This, of course, gave her a lot of latitude. She was able to finish junior high and high school work. She competed in the Special Olympics in Indiana a year ago last August, or now, well, 2 years ago now. She took third overall in gymnastics, a gold and 3 bronze. And I heard she had a boyfriend and showed her dog a dog show. She's now having a return of some of the seizures because there's been an uproar out in the prison program and the loss of some trainers. But they certified, it's a certified animal. And so it really changed her life. And you say, well, this is an aberration. No, they have now two other animals. If I had time, well, I might not have time. But there's two other animals now that pick up on this. And if we really knew what was happening, and we need research in this, this could help a lot of people. In fact, I have recommended for epileptics what they ought to have is the right kind of animal for them. It would probably reduce the amount of drugs they have to take, because it does reduce blood pressure and anxiety levels, and probably it would really help them out a lot. So that's a miracle. Here's my wife and her dog. And we do demonstrations at a lot of places. You see, it's orange or yellow leash, and that's an indication of a hearing dog. Certified, she carries an ID card, and she has access to any place, public places. It's notifying her that the phone is ringing. Does a lot of other things. Partnership in equine therapy and education. Fantastic program. We are the first university to have a riding for the handicap program. The miraculous things are happening in this, using horseback. Now the Germans, now we have third-party payment in some places. My friend Ruth Dismuke down in Albuquerque, she does a speech therapy on the horse, finds out remarkable things happen. It really got going when Liz Hartel and Elizabeth Bartik in Norway and in Denmark. Liz Hartel was a polio victim. And in 52, she was, by polio, she was paralyzed from the waist down. And she took a silver medal in the 1952 Olympics in dressage. And they realized then, and that's what was pursued in both in Scandinavia and I guess later in England, for polio patients, we wouldn't do anything with physical therapy. They put them on a horse and things happened. There are now all kinds of riding for the handicap programs. In Germany, more recently, developed what they call hippotherapy, where you kind of take you pick out the horse for the patient. You kind of ride bareback. And because you see the action of a horse, you can't really imitate the three-dimensional movement of a horse. And it has something, probably affects the vestibular apparatus, coordination, a lot of things, muscular strength. But it essentially mimics walking, that three-dimensional movement of walking. That's why some people now, for example, spina bifida are walking, and others who have been damaged are able to walk and talk and a lot of other things. In Germany and Switzerland, they get third-party payment. Ruth Dismuke gets third-party payment for her speech therapy in the horse in Albuquerque. So this is a growing thing. We've sent to the Delta Society people to Germany to learn this technique, so you'll see more of it. There's some really remarkable things happening. I can't tell you the whole story of this. I might tell it to you later. We'll see what else we got here. But with horseback riding, you know, you take a child like that on crutches or in a wheelchair all his life, suddenly vaulted on a horse. Up to this time, it's been looking up. Now it's on a horse looking down, going places, never been competing in actions, never been. You see some really remarkable things happen. And a lot of this is the international resource center for this kind of thing is the Delta Society, which I helped found. And we started out, a friend of mine who was named Mike McCulloch from Portland will recall 4 years ago last June 26th that Michael McCulloch, who was a well-known psychiatrist, internationally known, and was a founder of the Delta Foundation back in the mid-70s, was also on our faculty for our regional veterinary program in the Northwest and also in medicine, but a very active psychiatrist. 4 years ago, last June 26th, a former crazed patient came into the office and blew his brains out. So we lost a lot. He was my vice president, and I look forward to him and one of my closest friends. But when he started this, he says he called it the Delta, people, animals, and health and allied professionals. And we got to research this, he said. We've added to that some more deltas to study, serve, and teach environment, animals, and people. And I've added another one to it, maybe that's here, people, animals, and peace. If some of you are interested in this, I can give you information. Our international headquarters are in Renton, Washington. And we have resource packages, and we deal in these matters. I feel that this can be children, animals, and peace can be a basis for discussion across many countries, because every country has a number of people who are very committed to their children and to their animals, and it's a safe subject for discussion. And you'll find, if you, and I'm sure you know this as well as I, that if you can put children of many languages and races in a room and they will communicate. By the same thing, animals also have, they can communicate with one another. And also, neither animals nor children respect state boundaries. It is only we adults who do that. So I feel that this can be a basis for discussion with countries. That's most of the dogma for today. I am going to read you something here in a minute. In fact, I'll do it right now if I can find it. Because I was going to tell you this neat story about that fellow that I showed you on that horse. Mike was a very bright lad, born in St. Louis. And he excelled in about everything. But when he got to be 8 or 9, he started losing ground. He realized he couldn't compete physically with the children. And it was diagnosed as Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, which is not consistent with living really beyond teenage years. And he was exceedingly depressed. But a horse trainer, a lady that was in charge of a riding for the handicap program, says, "What you need is a horse." And she found him a horse that in itself had been handicapped. His name was Dancer. And Dancer could understand this boy, and Mike could understand the horse. They became a fantastic team. And even though he couldn't do a lot of things like pressing against and signaling, this horse could understand him. And he actually won in dressage. But he was losing ground. And in the Delta Society, we have a lot of awards for distinguished service of people, but we also have for animals, horses, dogs, and hearing dogs, and all those kind of things. He was in competition 2 years ago for the outstanding horse, Dancer. And it was a beautiful story, and we were all pulling for him. But the leading riding for the handicapped Chef Center in Michigan finally won out by a few points. And we had to call up and tell the trainer that he didn't win. And she said, "It's going to break his heart." Mm-hmm. Because he was going to compete, probably his last time, in San Francisco at a meet, and they canceled it. And I says, "He is going to receive an award. Since I was president, you give the president's award, you see? We inaugurated the president's award." And he was, of course, thrilled with this because he'd hoped to be on television and newspapers, you see? By this time, he's about 13. He made an application to the Dream Factory, which people who are terminal, and he got his mother and grandmother with him. We met them at the Vancouver, British Columbia Airport, where our meeting was held. Held it in, of course, the Delta Hotel. And he was met by a big, long limousine with all kinds of balloons, and he had a special suite with his mother and grandmother in the hotel. He had a demonstration ride the next day. He was in the newspapers and on television. And then the night for the award came. And so I introduced him. He was the last one on the program that night at the banquet. And I told the people about a brief on his story, some of the things that I've told you. And then I turned the mic over to Mike. In a relatively weak voice, he said this. And what I'm going to read you is from a little booklet he sent me called The Springtime of My Life. It was the only thing he had, you see. But a very moving story. He said, "Every hour of every day, 365 days a year, I ride. I ride in a blue and silver wheelchair. It bothers me when people stare, but maybe they really do care. There are many things I can't do. Wouldn't this upset you too? 1.5 hours a day, about 52 days a year, I ride. I ride in a dark brown Connemara. Dancer is my very best friend. Upon her I often depend. Without wheels, she makes me feel free. That's all I really want to be. There wasn't a dry eye in the audience, and everybody stood and clapped. It was probably the best couple of days of his life. It is well we gave him those days, because he died the following May. But before he died, he got this letter from his senator, Senator John Danforth, because I turned some of this material over to the present vice president of the Dr. Strimple in Washington, D.C., and one of his, he's a veterinarian, one of his clients is Senator Danforth. So Senator Danforth says, "Dear Mike, what a great sense of accomplishment and pride you must feel to have received the President's Award of the Delta Society. Dr. Strimple has told me of your wonderful success with Dancer. It must give you a great sense of satisfaction to have become such a proficient rider. But I'm sure you know that your accomplishments extends much beyond yourself. Stands as a beacon of hope for everyone who must overcome an obstacle in the quest of excellence. What a great message for you to give to the rest of the world. All dreams are possible if they are pursued with faith and dedication. You are an inspiration, young man, and I want you to know that I am so proud of you. My prayers are with you. Your friend, John Danforth." As you know, John Danforth is also a theologian. He's degreed in theology from Yale and conducts services. In fact, I went to one of his morning services in Washington, D.C. at the Episcopal Chapel there.
Just a reminder, it's 11:45 now in the first station.
And here's the last slide, and this is it. And this is your assignment, okay? To cure sometimes, to relieve often, but to comfort always. It's from the stained glass windows of Mayo House in Rochester, Minnesota. So having given your assignment, you can leave.